The animated conversation that Ralph had interrupted was resumed, with Mr. Rhodes orchestrating and directing it. "What about your trained zebras?" he demanded of Zuga, who shook his golden beard. It was a desperate measure and doomed from the outset. But when you consider that out of the 100,000 head of cattle that we had in Matabele land before the Rinderpest, only 500 or so have survived, any chance seemed worth taking. "They say that the Cape Buffalo have been wiped out utterly and completely by the disease," Dr. Jamieson suggested. "What do you think, Major?" "Their losses have been catastrophic. 2 weeks ago I rode as far north as the Pundamatenga River, where a year ago I counted herds of over 5,000 together. This time I saw not a single living beast. Yet I cannot believe they are now extinct. I suspect that somewhere out there are scattered survivors, the ones that had a natural immunity, and I believe that they will breed." Mr. Rhodes was not a sportsman. He had once said of his own brother Frank, "Yes, he's a good fellow, he hunts and he fishes. In other words, he's a perfect loafer." And this conversation about wild game bored him almost immediately. He changed it by turning to Ralph. "Your railway line, what is the latest position, Ralph?"
We are still almost 2 months ahead of our schedule," Ralph told him with a touch of defiance. "We crossed the Matabeleland border 15 days ago. I expect, as we sit here, that the railhead has reached the trading post at Plumtree already."
"It's as well," Rhodes nodded. "We shall have urgent need of your line in a very short while."
And he and Dr. Jim exchanged a conspiratorial glance.
When they had all relished Louise's bread and butter pudding, thick with nuts and raisins and running with wild honey, Zuga dismissed the servants and poured the cognac himself, while Jordan carried around the cigars. As they settled back in their seats, Mr. Rhodes made one of his startlingly abrupt changes of subject and pace, and Ralph was immediately aware that the true purpose for which he had been summoned to King's Lynn was about to be revealed.
"There is not one of you who does not know that my life's task is to see the map of Africa painted red from Cape Town to Cairo, to deliver this continent to our Queen as another jewel in her crown."
His voice, that had been irritable and carping up until now, took on a strange mesmeric quality.
"We men of the English-speaking Anglo-Saxon race are the first among nations, and destiny has imposed a sacred duty upon us to bring the world to peace under one flag and one great monarch. We must have Africa, all of it, to add to our Queen's dominions. Already my emissaries have gone north to the land between the Zambezi and the Congo rivers to prepare the way."
Rhodes broke off and shook his head angrily.
"But all this will be of no avail if the southern tip of the continent eludes us."
"The South African Republic," said Jamieson. "Paul Kruger and his little banana republic in the Transvaal." His voice was low but bitter.
"Do not be emotive, Dr. Jim," Rhodes remonstrated mildly. "Let us concern ourselves merely with the facts."
"And what are the facts, Mr. Rhodes?" Zuga Ballantyne leaned forward eagerly from the head of the table.
"The facts are that an ignorant old bigot, who believes that the rabble of illiterate Dutch nomads that he leads are the new Israelites, specifically chosen by their Old Testament god, this extraordinary personage, sits astride a vast stretch of the richest part of the African continent like an unkempt and savage hound with a bone, and growls at all efforts at progress and enlightenment."
They were all silenced by this bitter invective, and Mr. Rhodes looked around at their faces before he went on.
"There are 38,000 Englishmen on the goldfields of the Witwatersrand, Englishmen who pay £19 of every 20 of the revenue that flows into Kruger's coffers. Englishmen who are responsible for every bit of civilization in that benighted little republic, and yet Kruger denies them the franchise. They are taxed mercilessly and denied representation. Their petitions for the vote are greeted in the Volksraad by the contemptuous derision of a motley assembly of untutored oafs."
Rhodes glanced at Fitzpatrick.
"Am I being unfair, Percy? You know these people. You live with them on a day-to-day basis. Is my description of the Transvaal Boer accurate?"
Percy Fitzpatrick shrugged. "Mr. Rhodes is correct. The Transvaal Boer is a different animal from his Cape cousins. The Cape Dutch have had the opportunity of absorbing some of the qualities of the English way of life. By comparison, they are an urbane and civilized people, while the Transvaaler has unfortunately lost none of the traits of his Dutch ancestry. He is slow, obstinate, hostile, suspicious, cunning, and malevolent. It galls a man to be told to go to hell by that ilk, especially when we ask only for our rights as free men, the right to vote. Mr. Rhodes, not long to be denied the floor, went on.
Not only does Kruger insult our countrymen, but he plays other, more dangerous games. He has discriminated against British goods with punitive tariffs. He has given trade monopolies in all essential mining goods, even dynamite, to members of his family and government. He is blatantly arming his burghers with German guns and building a corps of German Krupp artillery. And he is openly flirting with the Kaiser.
Rhodes paused.
A German sphere of influence in the midst of Her Majesty's domains would forever damn our dreams of a British Africa. The Germans do not have our altruism.
All that good yellow gold going to Berlin, Ralph mused softly, and immediately regretted having spoken.
But Mr. Rhodes did not seem to have heard, for he went on.
How to reason with a man like Kruger? How can one even talk to a man who still believes implicitly that the earth is flat?
Mr. Rhodes was sweating again, although it was cool in the room.
His hand shook so that as he reached for his glass, he knocked it over, and the golden cognac spread across the polished tabletop.
Jordan rose quickly and mopped it up before it could cascade into Mr. Rhodes's lap. And then he took a silver pillbox from his fob pocket, and from it placed a white tablet close to Mr. Rhodes's right hand. The big man took it, and still breathing heavily, placed it under his tongue. After a few moments his breathing eased, and he could speak again.
I went to him, gentlemen. I went to Pretoria. I went there to see Kruger at his own home. He sent a message with a servant that he could not see me that day.
They had all of them heard this story. Their surprise was only that Mr. Rhodes could recount such a humiliating incident. President Kruger had sent a black servant to one of the richest and influential men in the world with this message. I am rather busy at the moment. One of my burghers has come to discuss a sick ox with me. Come back on Tuesday.
God knows, Dr. Jim intervened to break the embarrassed silence, Mr. Rhodes has done everything a reasonable man could. To risk another insult from this old boor could bring discredit not only on Mr. Rhodes personally, but on our Queen and her empire.
The little doctor paused and looked at each of his listeners in turn. Their faces were rapt. They waited intently for his next words.
What can we do about it? We must do something. What must we do about it?
Mr. Rhodes shook himself and looked at the young staff officer in his resplendent mess kit.
Bobby,
he said in invitation. Gentlemen, you may be aware that I have just returned from the Transvaal. Bobby White lifted a leather briefcase from the floor beside his chair to the table, and from it produced a sheaf of crisp white paper. He passed a sheet to every man at the table. Ralph glanced at his copy and started slightly. It was the order of battle of the Army of the South African Republic. His surprise was so intense that he missed the first part of what Bobby White was saying. The fort at Pretoria is under repair and extension. The walls have been breached for this purpose and will be entirely vulnerable to a small, determined force. Ralph had to force himself to believe what he was hearing. Apart from the corps of artillery, there is no regular standing army. As you can see from the paper before you, the Transvaal depends upon its citizen commandos for defence. It requires 4 to 6 weeks for them to assemble into an effective force. Bobby White finished his recital, and Mr. Rhodes turned from him to Percy Fitzpatrick.
Percy,
he invited.
You know what Kruger calls those of us whose capital and resources have developed his gold mining industry for him. He calls us the Uitlanders, the outlanders, the foreigners. You know also that we outlanders have elected our own representatives, which we call the Johannesburg Reform Committee. I have the honour to be one of the elected members of that committee, and so I speak for every Englishman in the Transvaal. He paused and carefully dressed his moustache with his forefinger, and then went on. I bring you two messages. The first is short and simple. It is, we are determined and united to the cause.
You may rely upon us to the utmost." The men about the table nodded, but Ralph felt his skin tingle. They were taking this seriously. It was not some boyish nonsense. They were plotting one of the most audacious acts of piracy in history. He kept his expression serious and calm with an enormous effort, as Fitzpatrick went on. "The second message is in the form of a letter signed by all the members of the Reform Committee. With your permission, I shall read it to you. It is addressed to Dr. Jamieson in his capacity as Administrator of Rhodesia, and it reads as follows. Johannesburg. Dear Sir, the position of matters in this state has become so critical that we are assured that at no distant period there will be a conflict between the Transvaal government and the Uitlander population." As the letter unfolded, Ralph recognized that it was a justification for armed insurrection. "A foreign corporation of Germans and Hollanders is controlling our destinies, and in conjunction with the Boer leaders, endeavouring to cast them in a mould which is wholly alien to the genius of the British peoples." They were going to try to take by force of arms the richest gold reef in existence. Ralph sat bemused. "When our petition for franchise was debated in the Transvaal Volksraad, one member challenged the Uitlanders to fight for the rights they asked for, and not a single member spoke against him. The Transvaal government has called into existence all the elements necessary for armed conflict. It is under these circumstances that we feel constrained to call upon you as an Englishman to come to our aid should a disturbance arise. We guarantee any expense you may incur by helping us, and we ask you to believe that nothing but sternest necessity has prompted this appeal." Percy Fitzpatrick looked up at Dr. Jim and then finished. "It is signed by all the members of the committee. Leonard Phillips, Mr. Rhodes's brother Francis, John Hayes Hammond, Farrar, and by myself. We have not dated it." At the head of the table, Zuga Ballantyne let out his breath in a low whistle. But nobody else spoke, while Jordan rose and passed down the table, refilling each glass from the crystal decanter. Mr. Rhodes was slumped forward over the table, his chin resting on the heel of his hand, staring out of the windows down across the lawns towards the far blue line of hills. The hills of the Indunas, where once the Matabele King's kraal had stood. Everybody at the table waited for him, until at last he sighed heavily. I much prefer to find a man's price and pay it, rather than to fight him. But we are not dealing with a normal man here. God save us all from saints and fanatics. Give me a solid rogue every time." His head turned towards Dr. Jamieson, and the dreaming blue eyes focused. "Dr. Jim," he invited, and the little doctor rode his chair back on its hind legs and thrust his hands deep into his pockets. "We will need to send 5,000 rifles and 1,000,000 rounds of ammunition into Johannesburg." Intrigued and fascinated despite himself, Ralph interrupted to ask, Where will you get those? They are not common trade goods." Dr. Jim nodded. "That's a good question, Ballantyne. The rifles and ammunition are already in the mine stores of De Beers at Kimberley." Ralph blinked. The plot was far advanced, further than he had believed possible. Then he recalled the little doctor's suspicious behaviour at the base camp, from which they had discovered the Harkness Reef. They must have been busy for months. He must find out the details. "How will we get them into Johannesburg? They'll have to be smuggled in, and it's a bulky shipment." "Ralph," Mr. Rhodes smiled, "you didn't really believe you were invited here for a social luncheon? Who would you judge to be the most experienced of us in shipping weapons? Who carried the Martini rifles to Lobengula? Who is the shrewdest transport operator on the subcontinent?"
"Me?" Ralph was startled.
"You,"
agreed Mr. Rhodes.
And as Ralph stared at him, he felt a sudden unholy excitement welling up within him. He was to be at the centre of this fantastic conspiracy, privy to every detail. His mind began to race. He knew intuitively that this was one of the opportunities that comes a man's way once in a lifetime, and he had to wring from it every last advantage.
"You will do it, of course?"
A small shadow passed across the penetrating blue eyes.
"Of course," said Ralph,
But the shadow persisted. "I am an Englishman. I know my duty." Ralph went on quietly and sincerely. And he saw the shadow clear from Mr. Rhodes's eyes. That was something he could believe in, something he could trust. He turned back to Dr. Jamieson.
"I'm sorry," Mr. Rhodes said. "We interrupted you."
And Jamieson went on. "We will raise a mounted force of around 600 picked men here." And he looked at John Willoughby and Zuga Ballantyne, both of them proven soldiers. "I will rely heavily on you two." And Willoughby nodded. But Zuga frowned and asked, 600 men will take weeks to ride from Bulawayo to Johannesburg.